Good afternoon, folks from the East Coast. I want to first welcome you to the AUCD Research Topics of Interest webinar today. It's being presented by the Association of University Centers and supported by a cooperative agreement from the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Before we get started with this webinar, I wanted to go ahead and just go over a little bit of the agenda. Welcome, everybody. I am Sue Lin. I'm the project director for the cooperative agreement between IUCD and the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. And we're very privileged to have the speakers with us today to talk about the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder in children with Down syndrome. Is there an association? This is a study that was funded in 2005 through our cooperative agreement, and I think it's one of the first epidemiology studies of its kind looking at the prevalence rate and the comorbidity between autism spectrum disorder and Down syndrome. We have Drs. Susan Hyman and Steve Salkis with us from the Strong Center for Developmental Disabilities, which is our New York University Center of Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. Another project, we funded two projects in 2005. One was in New York, the other one was in Colorado. And from Colorado, we have Dr. Cordelia Robinson and Susan Hepburn with us today. We also are very honored to have Dr. Diana Schendel, who is the scientific collaborator at the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at CDC, who has been working with both of our projects as they're going through and gathering data. And she will be giving us some of her comments and also initiating the question and answer period. You're going to be hearing the presentation for about the next 60 minutes, and we're definitely going to have an opportunity for you to post your questions to our presenters. Let me just start by telling you a little bit about the cooperative agreement. I spoke that, these two studies that are funded in New York and Colorado are funded through our cooperative agreement, and this cooperative agreement really began in 2002 to strengthen the nation's capacity to carry out public health and disability activities. We know that we need to be collaborating at all different levels in terms of, carrying out these public health and disability initiatives. So, AUCD really works with its members, other community partners, and especially the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities to carry out these initiatives. We do this through facilitating research, education, and dissemination activities. And today's webinar is a dissemination activity from the research findings of our research topics of interest projects. Just a little bit overview of what projects are going on within our cooperative agreement and what areas of public health and disability it's covering at this point. We have projects that have looked at health communication education, prevention of secondary conditions, healthcare cost analysis, quality of life studies, health promotion interventions, and comorbidity prevalence studies, of which you're going to hear about today. The disabilities have really been across the spectrum of disabilities, have included autism, Down syndrome, muscular dystrophy, hearing loss, fetal alcohol syndrome, spina bifida, and Tourette syndrome. And the list keeps growing depending on what are some of the needs areas that have been identified by the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. Okay, wanted to give you sort of a visual of our presenters and discussant today. As we're doing this webinar to you via four different locations, we have people from Rochester, New York. We have people from Denver, Colorado. I'm actually doing this off-site from our AUCD offices in Columbus, Ohio. And then I have a counterpart, Ilya Nikola Lisa Bishop, who is at the AUCD Central Office coordinating this with me. So I wanted to sort of put a picture to the names of the people that you will be hearing from this afternoon. Okay. Just a little bit on logistics. This is a operator-assisted call, which is delivering the audio component of our webinar today. So all the participants' lines are muted during the presentation. The operator will be assisting us with the question and answer period, and she's going to provide you all with some instructions on how you can pose your questions and join the queue that, and she will help you open that line so that you can pose the questions to the presenters. In addition to posing your questions through the teleconference line, you can also send in a text message to us with any questions that you may have as you're going through the as you're hearing the presentation. We definitely recognize that you'll have a lot of questions as you're hearing the contents of the presentation, and please feel free to text us through the webinar menu that should be on the right of your screen, and we will share all those questions and comments with the presenters at the end of the webinar. Okay, so at that point, I actually will ask the operators to give instructions on the question and answer period as soon as we're ready to do so. But so at this time, I'm going to go ahead give the floor to the folks in Rochester to lead us off. Please bear with us as we do this transition. We're actually going to be controlling the PowerPoint slides from multiple locations today, and we've did a very successful run through last week, and I think you will be hopefully you'll bear with us as we do each of these transitions. So I'm going to pass the floor over to Dr. Susan Hyman and Dr. Steve Salkis, and as soon as they're ready to go ahead and load, and it looks like Dr. Susan Hyman is ready to go, I will pass the floor over to Susan.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming out or sitting in this afternoon, and we'll start by reviewing the two sites. We're here at the University of Rochester in upstate New York, and our colleagues are in Colorado. And I have to see where that thing is. First, what I'd like to do is set the stage for why we're doing these projects and why AUCD and CDC were so interested. You all know about Down syndrome. Down syndrome is a common cause of intellectual disability. At this point in time, the prevalence in live births is about 1 in 800, maybe a few years ago. The survival rate is increasing with better cardiac care, with survival rates in the U.S. at almost 90%. You also know that autism spectrum disorders in terms of prevalence are a very hot topic. A few years ago, there was a report of a dramatic increase in the rate of diagnosis and seeking services for children with autism spectrum disorders in California, which precipitated concern about either an epidemic or a rash of increased diagnoses. A number of studies looking at the epidemiology of autism followed, starting with a CDC-sponsored study in Brick Township in New Jersey, which documented that indeed the prevalence of autism was much higher than that which had previously been reported, at 4 to 5 per 10,000, was as high as 40 per 10,000 of autism and 60 per 10,000 if you included all pervasive developmental disorders. What followed were a number of studies using different epidemiologic designs looking at populations in the UK, where with young children, a rate of almost 46 per 10,000 of all ASDs was identified. A school-based study, again sponsored by the CDC in Metro Atlanta, identified a rate that was slightly lower, but again, it was based on school records rather than actual actual assessment of children. And then another, this is the only real incident study that was done at Mayo looking at Olmsted County in Minnesota. Two more recent studies, one being a survey study, which is quite interesting, where other databases were surveyed looking at parent report of the diagnosis of autism, and in those circumstances, 55 in one study, 57 in another per 10,000, families were given a diagnosis of autism for their children. It didn't differ with age. And this is important because these are clinical diagnoses in the community, which is not too different from the Brick Township case finding and gold standard diagnosis. And then most recently, again, CDC-funded epidemiologic studies through their surveillance network has come in with some data where overall, at the sites around the country, 66 per 10,000 on average, with a low in Alabama and a high in New Jersey. And I guess that's the topic of another discussion. Now, we know that some genetic disorders do place children at increased risk for autism. Fragile X syndrome was probably the first and best investigated. Smith-Lemli-Opitz, tuber sclerosis has been fairly extensively investigated because of the high rate of comorbidity. The search for genetic causes of autism have suggested that a substantial but very small minority may have duplication on chromosome 15 in the Prader-Willi or Angelman region. The Rett area has been extensively studied and will continue to be extensively studied, a disorder that we don't see in this country particularly anymore, but used to be a major cause of both intellectual disability and symptoms of autism with PKU. And the question is the comorbidity of Down syndrome and autism greater than what you would expect for that of intellectual disability alone? Why is it important to understand the genetic comorbidities with autism? Well, it may help in the understanding of the neurobiology of both disorders, help understand the phenotypic symptoms of autism, whether or not there are discrete subtypes with different types of genetic disorders. And it also, from a clinical standpoint, is tremendously important because the provision of appropriate services for children and adults with dual diagnosis will open up new avenues of ability. If indeed there's an increased comorbidity, new screening recommendations may be important for the specific genetic disorder. And for the families, it's really very important for them to understand why their child might be different than other children with similar genetic diagnoses. So if we were just to do the numbers and had the prevalence of 12.5 per 10,000 of Down syndrome and 66 per 10,000 of autism, if you just do the numbers, the comorbidity would be vanishingly small. It would be 0.00001. I think I may have put in an extra zero. But when you look at the few studies that have been done to date, the comorbidity of Down syndrome and autism spectrum disorder is really much greater than that. There was one school-based study in the UK where they looked at children who attended multiple clinics and schools for children with intellectual disability. They screened 58 children with Down syndrome, found four who fulfilled diagnostic criteria for autism spectrum disorders as defined by in 1999 at a 7% prevalence. But in many of the others, they found what we would think of as maybe PDD at this point with rituals and obsessions and other symptoms. The comorbidity of autism and Down syndrome has been reported in other clinical samples. Sweden, for example, they found 25 cases over a 15-year period. Many of these had a family history of autism. Another subgroup had infantile spasms, which may place you at risk for autism separately. In examination of the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, 13 kids with Down syndrome were tested on the Autism Diagnostic Interview, which is we'll be talking about later, which is a parent-based report measure, plus a play-based measure, the ADOS, which elicits the symptoms of autism. And they found a greater than expected rate of positive symptoms, but the children who were positive on the interview measure and on the play-based measure were not necessarily the same subjects, which also will be important later. George Capone, a colleague in Baltimore in this country, looked at his clinic sample and found of the 64 youngsters that he followed with autism and Down syndrome, that they tended to have increased amount of stereotype behavior. And he separated out this other interesting group of children who he did not qualify as having autism but had Down syndrome and stereotype behavior. And these stereotypies or repetitive movements were far more simple than the stereotype behavior seen in the children that were clinically classified as having autism. And lastly, the large number of youngsters were evaluated in a study in the Netherlands, where they looked at an entire region to look at what the true comorbidity of intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorders were. And although this group, Krager and De Bilt, did not report their prevalence data, they did report that children who were comorbid with Down syndrome and intellectual disability had lower scores in the autism range but seemed to have more symptoms that could be construed as the broader phenotype or perhaps PDD in the at-risk range. So what about this morbidity with intellectual disability and the autism spectrum? I was talking about Krager's group. They looked at an entire population region, and they found that when they took their clinical diagnoses using DSM-IV, that the overall total comorbidity of intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorders was at about 17%, and it increased as the cognitive disability increased. Similar types of studies were done in Italy, where in residential care the rate was higher. These were older individuals and may have had more social isolation because of the nature of residential care. And what De Bilt and Krager reported later on in a large sample of individuals with intellectual disability is that what you call autism spectrum disorders is somewhat variable depending on the instruments you use and how you ask the question, which leads us to the instruments. Both the ARTOI sites in Rochester and in Colorado started out with screening. The two screening tests that we both elected to use were the modified checklist for autism in toddlers. Most of you know about this test. It's a paper and pencil test administered to parents of young children, standardized for kids between 18 and 36 months. The initial standardization sample was done in pediatric practices and children referred for early intervention. Limited numbers of kids who had significant cognitive limitation in the initial standardization sample, and was designed to be an initial paper and pencil test with follow-up telephone call. In our study, we administered this as solely a paper and pencil task. We administered the social communication questionnaire to all the children as well. This is a 40-item paper and pencil task for parents to complete, looking at both current and past symptoms suggestive of autism, and was designed to relate to the autism diagnostic interview, which is a more extensive interview eliciting symptoms of autism, and scored as either positive or negative for autism. Doesn't give you an intermediate score. We're not going to be reporting today on our data on the pervasive developmental disorder PDD-MRS scale, which is what Krager and his group used, because we didn't use this in common with Colorado. But it certainly is a promising area to pursue. The autism diagnostic interview is an extensive measure. It's been studied for a large number of individuals with autism. Like the screening tests, however, the standardization sample for people with mental retardation and very low mental ages is growing but may compromise our ability to use it in a large scale fashion, and that's again the data we're going to be presenting. And the autism diagnostic interview is designed to provide family information, parent history, but the autism diagnostic observation schedule is a face-to-face assessment with standard play materials and language materials so that you can elicit the symptoms of autism and compare them to norms. And the ADI and ADOS are designed to be used together, but neither is what you would use solely for a diagnosis of autism. You still have to use all of these to inform your DSM-4 diagnostic criteria. So clinical diagnosis is to be taken from all those sources of information. And now I'm going to turn this over to Steve Salkis.
Transient Musical Chairs in Rochester. Okay, so what was done here in New York State and also in Colorado was to use a birth registry to ascertain the regional cohort. We worked in New York with our New York State Department of Health Congenital Malformation Registry, and our Colorado colleagues worked with a comparable office in their state. We also sucked in more patients from other sources, including parent support groups and clinic populations. There were slight differences in the design of the two projects, and this shows them, as it also shows the two most beautiful cities in the United States. Although there always is a cloud over Rochester, I suppose. Anyway, in New York, we used a tiered assessment that I'll talk more about in a moment. At level one, we used screens. At level two, we administered the ADI on kids who were both screen positive and screen negative controls. And then at level three, and the ADI was administered over the phone, at level three, we used a geographic sample to administer the in-person ADOS for kids who'd come up positive on the ADI and some who came up negative on the ADI. The Denver folks will talk more about their procedure when they get on the phone, but theirs was also a population study, again, using screening, but all screen positives got the whole schmear, and two-thirds of those who were screen negative went on to the complete evaluation. Okay. In New York State, the specific aims were to look at the comorbidity of ASDs and Down syndrome. Outside of New York City, we were advised not to use the five boroughs of New York because of different RSRB kinds of requirements, and there was plenty of people in New York State outside of New York City for us to work with. We were looking at the tools that are used for screening and diagnosis. We used a medical checklist to see if we can correlate medical comorbidities with any of the behavior patterns that we're seeing. And we're also especially interested in the nature of the repetitive behaviors that kids who have Down syndrome have, both with and without associated autism spectrum disorder diagnoses. As I said, we used a multi-tiered screening approach, beginning with the MCHAT, the SEQ, and the medical history questionnaire. We also administered the PDD-MRS that Susan mentioned earlier via telephone. All kids who were screen positive, and I'll explain that in a second, got a telephone-based interview that included a Vineland II adaptive behavior scale, a repetitive behavior scale, and the ADI administered over the phone. We also did, as controls, the next kid who screened negative got the same level two battery. And at level three, all the kids who were ADI positive and the next ADI negative kid within our geographic catchment area got the parents completing a child behavior checklist and the SRS and the in-person ADOS, the LITER, which is a nonverbal intelligence test, and receptive and expressive vocabulary test. Okay, our population began with the 1,583 kids ages 3 to 13 in the part of New York State that I mentioned earlier who were registered with the Congenital Malformation Registry. a three-step recruitment process ensued with about 1,100 families contacted so far. About two-thirds of those we have completed our recruitment. There are 404 still going on as of last week. That divides out to about a 40% enrollment rate. We had lost about a third. Many were refusals or no response, and so we took those 286 who were enrolled, put them together with another 34 families, subjects who we found by contacting local support groups and our own clinic, Kirsch Center here at Strong, and so far we've enrolled 320 families. Okay, the demographics are shown here. The average age is 94 months, slightly different from what you're going to see in Colorado. Slight male preponderance. You see the parental ages, and you see the demographic breakdown. We don't show Latino families as a listing here. There were many Latino families, but because we were doing so much over the phone with questionnaires, and we didn't have Spanish language versions and adequate translating available, we did not include families where Spanish was their only or primary language. Where's my cursor? There it is. Okay. We have done some comparison of the demographics of those who consented versus those who refused, and you see a few differences. The main point in the comparison is probably in terms of parental education, where you see a somewhat higher level of participation among families where the parental education level was higher. There are some other differences, but again, our data are still being collected, and we haven't done any kind of statistical analysis on this yet. So far, what do we see? Well, a screen positive implied either a positive MCHAT or positive SCQ. Either one positive counted as a positive screen. Of those, you'll see that we have 57 kids who've had ADIs, of whom 38 were positive and 19 were negative. For the kids who were ADI positive, there were some who were ADOS positive and some who were ADOS negative. Same story for the ADI negative screen positive kids. Some, even though they had negative ADIs, they had positive ADOSs, or ADICE if you prefer. And and among some who were screen positive, they were both ADI negative and ADOS negative. So you'll see this pattern persist through some of the next slides. Look at the screen negatives. So 149 screen negatives, 69 of them have had ADIs. Relatively few of the screen negative kids had positive ADIs, but some of those who had positive ADIs had positive ADOSs. One ADOS positive, ADI positive kid was a negative ADOS. And again, similar interesting breakdown of inconsistency for the kids who were screen negative and ADI negative, some ADOS positive, some ADOS negative. Looking at it all together, 53% of our respondents came up positive on some screen. I should mention, going back to the previous slide, which I'm not going to do. Actually, I can do that, I guess. Screen negative meant that you had to be a negative screen on both the MCHAT and the SCQ. You had to be screen negative on both. I just wanted to make that point. Anyway, 53% screen positive on one or the other. And of those who we have carried out all the way through level 3, a third have been discordant between the ADI and the ADOS. And this is interesting because of the observations that Dr. Hyman mentioned a moment ago of the Dutch group in terms of what they found in folks who also had cognitive disability. There we go. So, what else can we say? what we think of as gold standards for screening and diagnosis are not so clear in terms of their meaning in kids with intellectual disability, and it appears in kids with Down syndrome. There is simply no substitute at the moment for using DSM-IV criteria. Having said that, and seeing that these patterns of inconsistency keep on the longer we do, the more subjects we bring through the project, have to say that it's still preliminary data and we haven't gone through our whole population. Where do we go next? We have to complete all our recruitment and test as many as possible. We have to see how the medical characteristics of our population correlate with the other findings that we're coming up with. We have to look in more detail at the nature of the repetitive behavior and the diagnoses that we make. And we especially want to look at the PDD-MRS instrument, which is specifically targeting individuals with intellectual disability as a screening tool for autism spectrum disorders. Finally, we hope to be able to pool data and findings with our colleagues in Colorado to draw broader conclusions. I think that's where we stop and our Colorado colleagues take over.
Should be Sue. No, don't turn yet, because we still have control.
Okay, we still have control. I'm ecstatic to have control. But I'm hoping that Sue Lynn and our Colorado colleagues take over the world in a moment.
Okay, well, this is Corey Robinson from Colorado, and very, you know, as has become apparent, or will become apparent, our projects were very similar in nature. We also had three aims, and our first aim was, as with Rochester, we were looking to conduct a population-based epidemiological study of the prevalence of ASD in children with Down syndrome. And we're, from our screen, we haven't advanced yet to...
How about if we do it for you?
Thank you. Okay. Sounds good.
There you go.
We will keep advancing as long as you tell us to.
Okay. All right. So you can now go to 27.
Okay.
The next slide. So the recruitment process that we used also, as Steve pointed out, involved working with our Department of Public Health and Environment with the birth registry for children with Down syndrome, and we were looking at the same age period, and our geographic area was 10 Front Range around Denver counties. Our first approach was to send letters to members of the Mile High Down Syndrome Society, families with children with Down syndrome in that 10 county area. And so that letter that went to the Mile High families, they contacted us if they were interested in participating, and then let us notify the health department so that they wouldn't get duplicate mailings. And the invitation to families was to participate in a screening study for social communication and behavioral difficulties, and said, and then possibly a follow-up diagnostic evaluation. So we can go to the next slide. And so,
Corey, just to interrupt for a minute, I am going to have Ilya transfer the control over to Colorado, because Colorado does have videos that they'll be showing in a little bit. So if the audience can bear with us, we're going to transfer control over to Colorado.
Okay. Meanwhile, I can go ahead and talk through this slide. So our total population inborn to these 10 counties were 497 children. Based upon the feedback that we've been able to get, returned letters from the CDPHE birth registry, we found out that 55 children of that 497 we identified death certificates for. 135 letters came back that we weren't able to track them down. And so our total N that we're assuming are traceable is 307. Of those, we've heard back from the 128 that you see here who are enrolled. We had four actively decline, and we've had 175 who have not responded. Within that enrolled group, we were also recruiting people through workshops that they were offering. And so 20 people within that 128 responded after workshops. They had already received the letter, but hadn't responded, so the workshop seemed to stimulate them to go ahead and respond. Okay, so...
speak a little bit louder. Corey, if you could speak a little bit louder. Some of our participants are not able to hear you as well, so if you could speak a little bit louder.
Okay. So we've had 138 inquiries to the project. Of those, 10 were not born in the counties that were the catchment area. Another, so the 128 were offered the screening for, after hearing about the opportunity for screening, said they were not interested, so that left us with our 124. Of the 124, for the data that we're presenting here, we've seen 114 of those people so far. And based upon age distribution, 7 years and younger, they received the MCHAT, so that's 78 children. Over 7 years of age received the SCQ. And so in this slide, you see our design, which showed that our plan and what we've carried through on was everyone who screened positive was offered a full evaluation. Our initial intent for those who screened negative was to select, to offer the screening to 50% of those who screened negative. Given that we had not heard from as many families as we initially hoped, we decided in order to be able to evaluate the screening tools, we really needed to see more. So we began to, we offered the follow-up evaluation to 63% of the screen negatives. And this next slide shows you for the MCHAT and the SCQ, how many screened negative, how many screened positive on each of those tools. Okay. So to show you, and this slide you can think about in comparison to the Rochester population, shows you the basic characteristics of our participants so far. and you'll see that the age of our children, just short of 70 months, is a younger sample than the Rochester sample at 94 months of age. We have even more males proportionately than Rochester does, with 59.3% male. Rochester's was 54%. Our parents are somewhat older than the Rochester sample. As you see, our mothers, an average age of 41.2 years compared to 33 for Rochester, and our fathers just shy of 40 years of age compared to 35 for Rochester. And Colorado does have a very substantial Hispanic population, and as you see, the distribution of our sample shows 11.5% Hispanic as our significant minority, 82% Caucasian, and 7.7% African American, and other 9.6%. Now, the reason it adds up to more than 100 is within the health department statistics in Colorado, they break out race versus ethnicity. So we have done so as well in reporting our sample. So the total number of people that we've screened to date, which is 114, we've only been able to do the complete follow-up evaluation on 58 individuals. So after doing this two-step process with these 58 individuals, we're seeing 10 or 17% receiving a clinical diagnosis of PDD-NOS, 4 or 7% meeting the criteria for autism, and 44 or 76% not meeting criteria for a co-occurring autism spectrum disorder. The next aim in our project was to look in more detail at the data from each of the two screening tools. And actually, just before the call, we discovered a numerical error in those slides. And given that they are small numbers, we're just going to skip over and proceed to aim three, and I'm going to let Susan Hepburn take over from here.
Okay, and we can try to update those numbers and get that information out. So in AIM 3, we were quite interested in trying to determine what sorts of child characteristics we're observing in the children with Down syndrome who also present with some significant impairments in social and communication skills. And as our colleagues in Rochester have described, many times we need to consider whether or not the intellectual disability is influencing the symptom presentation, as well as in our observations, and we have some hypotheses about these things in our study, we're curious to find out if temperamental factors within the child also influence parent report of difficulties in social interaction in particular, and then looking at some executive function and attention skills as a possible indicator of kids who might be at risk for, again, being reported as having social problems, which may or may not be autism-specific social issues. So our questions really are to ask ourselves, could the co-occurrence of autism within a child with Down syndrome be related to a low developmental level. And one of the things that we're trying to examine is whether or not an autism spectrum diagnosis becomes relevant only when the child's social development is below expectations for their overall developmental level. So, for example, we saw an 8-year-old child last week whose developmental level was around 12 months. His social behavior was around 12 months in a developmental sort of framework. So he didn't have a social disability relative to his developmental age, and we felt clinically that he did not then meet criteria for autism. So this is an area we want to continue to explore empirically, and I'll show some videotapes in a few minutes to try to explain what we're looking at. Our next hypothesis is to examine whether or not the co-occurrence could be related to a certain temperament style, with the idea that we are seeing some social difficulties and maybe even some impaired reciprocity, but not necessarily because of a problem in core social relatedness, like you would see in a child with classic autism, but perhaps related to maybe an inflexible behavioral style or a child who prefers to take the lead and has some difficulty being on the receiving end of an interaction. Then third, we want to try to examine empirically whether or not a child's abilities and executive function tasks have anything to do with the symptom presentation that we see, particularly in the area of social communication and repetitive activities. So the measures in our study, first we use a cognitive or developmental test that is appropriate for the child's age. For the younger kids, we've been using the Mullen Scales of Early Learning. If we can, we get the children on the preschool scales of the differentiability scales. We also do a parent interview using the Vineland to understand the child's skills and behaviors in home and community settings. And we've added a few other measures in our battery to examine the role of temperament, possibility of an executive function deficit, problem behavior, and sensory issues as well. So let's take two of these hypotheses and explore them in a little more detail. And I'm going to switch here in a moment to a movie to try to show you some examples. But let me start with some data, very preliminary data from our sample. So looking at intellectual disability, what you have here is a graph that demonstrates using sort of the older model of severity of cognitive impairment, so defining IQ scores and ranges, with mild being 55 to 70, as DSM-IV might suggest, moderate 35 to 55, and severe and profound less than 35. What you can see is a general trend here towards the idea that children with more significant cognitive impairments are more likely to screen positively on either the MCHAT or the SCQ. Then when we look specifically at whether or not it's likely that a child is on or off the spectrum based on clinical diagnosis, we continue to see a possible trend towards cognitive status having an impact on that. But what I also find interesting is while you don't see any children with autism in the context of Down syndrome who have a mild intellectual disability, we do see representations of children who have more of a PDD and OS profile who do have just mild impairments. So this is something we have to continue to explore. And I think pooling data with Rochester is going to be very helpful here. So now what I'd like to do, if folks, oh good, hopefully this will work. We've edited together a little film that I know sound might be hard, so I'm actually going to just try to narrate. Wanted to share with you some samples of kids from the project, and this is done with great appreciation to the families who've allowed us to use samples of their children's videotape. So I'm hoping that you are all seeing this. The first sample will be of Liam, 3 years, 2 months. His developmental age is around 11 months. So he could be described as a child who has a pretty significant cognitive impairment. What I'd like for you to look at, and it looks like the movie's running a little slowly, I hope it's transferring okay, is what we have here, even though he has a significant cognitive disability, we see some basic core relatedness. You'll see his attention to faces. You'll see some affect sharing. And he overall seems to be oriented to the people in the room. So here's a boy with Down syndrome and a significant intellectual disability who is able to engage in the social context in a way that is at least commensurate with his overall developmental level. And I'm hoping that these clips communicate what we see in them. It's hard to find 2 minutes that share that those observations. Interestingly, even though we decided clinically that Liam didn't meet criteria for autism, he had screened positively for it, and the ADI, I believe, was positive, although the ADOS was not, primarily for reasons like that, with the affect sharing that you're seeing for him right now. And as many of you know, the ADOS has several activities that pull for some of the behaviors that we feel are really important for identifying symptoms of autism in young children. And the requesting task, such as the balloon, is a good one for trying to get a sense of how well children can communicate their intentions and do they understand the process of intentional communication. And in my thinking as a clinician, as I'm trying to spend more and more time with these children, the presence of some intentionality seems to be occurring in the children who do not present with autism as opposed to those who may. So in contrast, let's look at Clarissa. She is 4 years, 4 months, and she has a very similar cognitive level to Liam. What I would like for you to see is to look at her social orientation as opposed to her object orientation. So this is Dr. Debbie Fidler at CSU working with Clarissa, who once again, 4.5 years old, developmentally like a 20 to 24 month old. You just saw there a little bit of a sighting behavior. And what I find remarkable here is just seeing how she's interested in the objects more than the person. So as we look at whether or not she knows to use the brush as a social kind of thing, she instead engages in some repetitive behaviors, and we don't see a lot of orienting to Debbie. Here's then a quick clip about trying to help Clarissa to interact with a doll and maybe do some basic social play.
Now, how is she doing with doll play in general?
We often see a lot of dropping and throwing behaviors when we present toys. And it seemed to us in watching Clarissa and by looking at parent report that some of the key items we use to screen for autism in a typical population, such as appropriate doll play, can be relevant, as she didn't seem to know how to play with the doll socially. Here's a task for following joint attention. Debbie is calling her name and trying to change gaze and then maybe point at something. And it seems as though Clarissa has a difficult time following the joint attention, which we are also seeing as possibly a very important early marker for the children with Down syndrome, as well as we've seen in the general pediatric population. Now, so those would be just some markers of social. We also then want to examine functional communication. What we're seeing overall clinically is for the children who seem to have comorbid autism, some difficulties coordinating verbal and nonverbal, a limited range of communicative functions, and as I mentioned, often impaired intentionality and difficulty coming up with generalizable requesting behaviors. So she seems to enjoy the balloon, and then as we watch to see how she attempts to request for more, kind of interesting. She's learned one behavior that an interventionist taught her, which is to slap the table or clap her hands, and yet that was about 2 years ago, and she hasn't yet learned another way to request. What I also think is notable is a lack of consistent use of eyes in combination with any sort of vocalization or other communicative intent. There, too, we see some positive affect, but it's not being shared with the adult. And this, to me, was very marked in some of the kids that we saw. Any of you who have done the ADOS, you occasionally hit the parent with a balloon. And what was notable to me about that is that the child didn't catch the affect. Now, what about our alternative explanations? Could it be a child's temperament that's bringing about what we might think about as false positives? So we have clips from two boys who scored positively for autism on the ADI, but not the ADOS. Here's Eddie, 5 years, a little over 5 years, with about a 25-month developmental level. And I'm going to try to include the sound here for you.
Phone. Did you see something you wanted to play with? You can play.
That right there was an excellent example of a good requesting behavior. He coordinated his eye gaze. He pointed. We have that sort of coordination of verbal and nonverbal. And now he's a good child to contrast with Clarissa, who we have, you know, in a similar sort of developmental range of functioning. And for Eddie, who did score within the autism range on the ABI, what we see is that while he may have some inappropriate social behaviors, such as throwing a lot of things, they are actually socially directed. So we've begun to wonder if that sort of temperament of being on their own terms is what's helping motivate the false positive. Now, here's a clip, too, of Jeremy at age 7, also within the moderate range, and I'm going to try to share the sound. This is working with Ashley Cole on a motor task.
May I try it?
No.
Is it my turn?
No.
Oh, are you going to do it?
No.
Okay. Okay. Your turn.
No.
Your turn.
No.
Hey,
look at it.
No. One at a time.
No.
No.
That was
mini.
Okay.
Is it Dad's turn?
No.
Yes. Okay. My turn. You ready?
Go.
One at a time.
Oh, good job, Dad.
All right.
Yay.
How many did I get? Yeah,
lots of
can you do more than that?
No.
Your turn.
No.
Do you want to try?
No.
You want to try?
No.
Are you ready?
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 Set. Go.
Come, hurry.
Two.
Come on.
No.
How come? Do you want to go to the park and play?
Yeah.
Then we have to do this. Okay. One at a time.
Oh, good.
Keep going.
Good job, Jimmy.
Poor guy, he does not need to do that again. Now, the reason that I wanted to show you Eddie and Jeremy is because, once again, both boys had obtained scores that were positive for autism on the ADI as well as on the screening tool. And then when we did the ADOS, we found that neither boy met criteria for full autism. And both required a lot of discussion. It was easier for us to notice that for Jeremy, many of his inappropriate social behaviors or inappropriate behaviors were very socially directed. And that to us seemed to be a very significant part of identifying the fact that while there may be sometimes a one-sidedness to his interactions, and particularly when challenged, he has many, many different ways of refusing a task, some appropriate, some not so much. He truly did not present with a pattern of impairment that's consistent with autism. So to bring it back then to the slideshow, as we look at temperament, these findings are preliminary and we'll continue to examine it. But something to note is we're finding that about of the children with Down syndrome who fall within a temperament category described by the Carey scales as somewhat difficult, 68% of those kids score above the autism cutoffs on the parent interview, the ADI, even though the clinician did not think they had autism. So we want to try to continue to pursue looking at temperament as a possible factor in some of the false positives we're seeing on the instruments relative to clinical diagnosis. We've also seen that there are some children who have difficulty in the social responsivity items on the ADOS, but do better on initiation. And so that's an interesting thing to continue to pursue. And we have also heard from parents that while a significant majority of children with Down syndrome are described as having poor friendships and to interact with others in maybe an on-their-own-terms kind of style, very few of these actually presented with a diagnosable autism spectrum disorder. So this has been a very challenging project and quite interesting to try to understand when it appears that a child is presenting with significant issues in social and communicative functioning, are they in fact something that we could attribute to developmental level, or are they perhaps related to a child's temperament or behavioral style, or down the line to look at things like sensory functioning and executive functioning. It's also interesting to think about some of the differences between autism as a comorbid medical diagnosis, where one might expect that perhaps there's a shared genetic factor to explore, and then also the children who may receive what might be described as more of an educational identification. In other words, where as children with Down syndrome who are very very impaired cognitively, school teams may find that they need to try some of the interventions that have been developed for children with autism, particularly to try to bring about some more gains in communication. So I'm also starting at least to think and to talk to other clinicians about what we mean by comorbidity. Do we truly mean some sort of a shared neurobiology, neurobiological etiology, or are we sometimes talking about a kind of functional comorbidity where regardless of factors, the child's presenting with some significant impairments that need to be addressed in a way that is qualitatively different than one might intervene with a child with Down syndrome who doesn't have that profile. And we're really looking forward to expanding our work in this area, gathering more subjects and participants, I should say, and pooling data with Rochester. So in conclusion, these are the first epidemiologic studies that have been done in this way to examine the rate of autism and ASD in children with Down syndrome. And the phenotype so far could be unique within Down syndrome. And it may be, as some of our collaborators have described, that the state-of-the-art assessments we use for autism may need some modifications in order to apply them well in this population of children. And also, we are continuing to find that considering clinical diagnosis is very important, and as Rochester adds more and more to our knowledge base on medical conditions and other factors to take into account, it's going to become all the more important to think thoroughly about a child's developmental and medical history, their current skills, what their parents are reporting, as well as what clinicians see. So at this point, I would like very much to thank our co-investigators in Colorado. We've had some great collaborators working with Deb Fidler in Colorado. Nancy Raitano-Lee did a lot of hard work on this project, and we are also grateful for the efforts of the folks at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment and the individuals at the Mile High Down Syndrome Association that helped us with recruitment. And at this point, I am going to attempt to pass it over to the Rochester group to finish making their comments.
I would like to thank in Rochester our collaborators, Edwin Van Wingarten in epidemiology, especially thank Lisa Rogers for her assistance with the slides, Caroline Magyar, who will be presenting some more interesting data with our friends in Colorado next week at the Southwest Autism Conference. And I want to acknowledge not only our other collaborators here, but Nancy Roizen at CASE. And we couldn't do this without our friends at the New York Congenital Malformation Registry or without the support of the Flower City Down Syndrome Network and the other family support groups in upstate New York. And if you want to move forward one.
I think we have.
Oh, we did that? And special thanks to the families, because it's all about the children. We also want to thank AUCD and CDC for their support all along the way, for making this possible, and for encouraging our collaboration over the next year and answering the questions we posed today. And now, Susan, you have to advance it.
Oh, I'm sorry. There we go.
And now we would like to answer your question.
Before we get the question and answer started, we have Dr. Diana Shandell on the line, as I've mentioned to you before. Diana is actually going to give us some comments with regarding to the presentation today, and also pose some questions for the folks that presented today. So, Diana?
I'm here.
Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me to comment on the two presentations. I must say I've always been very interested in the work that these two research groups have been carrying out, and I am confirmed after the presentations today of the great value and uniqueness of these data sets that are being generated through this investigation. It truly will be a remarkable contribution to our understanding of autism as well as Down syndrome, and so I'm very eager to see the results at the end, you know, after you have done all of your assessments and screening. I have a number of questions for the groups. I had some more methodologically oriented questions, which I think I'll hold until later if the interest and the opportunity comes up to address them. But I think I would, in the interest of time and perhaps interest for myself and the audience, the other people in the audience, that I'll move forward to some of the questions or comments I had concerning your results. And since you had both groups were focusing sort of in two areas, both on the understanding the prevalence of autism and Down syndrome, and then understanding more fully the phenotypic variability related to autistic features in children with Down syndrome. I'll sort of pick on those two broad areas for my comments. And so the first one regarding the prevalence, first question is just sort of a curiosity question. I mean, how many of the children that you've reviewed, and I understand it's a very small sample thus far, but were any of these children with Down syndrome already have a previous diagnosis of autism?
In Rochester, they sure did.
Were you pleasantly surprised that they had them, or was it were you finding more?
Many of the children who came in already diagnosed were from our area, so we knew them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And in this region, autism has had such a high we've done a lot of community education.
Mm-hmm.
That there for the Monroe County area, there may be more awareness among other professionals.
Okay. In Colorado, do you have the similar findings, similar discovery?
Yes, actually, no, we had a different finding, which was that only one of the children came with an existing diagnosis. We see a lot of what I might describe as diagnostic overshadowing, where parents have been told by clinicians and doctors that, well, those things can be attributed to the Down syndrome, and it hasn't been actively examined in most of the kids that we met.
Well, I would imagine that would have been my expectation, actually. So the Colorado experience fits my prediction, but New York, no. Maybe it does have something to do with the active outreach that you've had in that area. Perhaps it's reached the more parents than not.
But I was
looking at your results, and you do have, even of the subsamples or the partial samples that you've evaluated so far, you still are finding a large proportion of children with autism in your Down syndrome patients. 24% in Colorado, approximately, and about half at least screened positive in the Rochester sample, which is a very high proportion. Just in comparison, in our here in Atlanta, where we've linked our autism surveillance system with our congenital defects, the birth defects surveillance systems, we found an overlap of around only about a little less than 2% of children with Down syndrome also were identified with autism, based on these, just linking these two surveillance programs. So clearly, with a screening and more complete clinical evaluation, you're finding potentially more children with autism in your samples, which is maybe not so surprising. But I have a question in that regard for you. Who knows what the numbers will fall out to when you get all the way through, but it's unlikely they'll drop dramatically. I'm sure you'll continue to find this high proportion of kids with Down syndrome that also could be classified as have autism as well. But the question I have for you is a comment made by Eric von Bohn, who's an epidemiologist, a very prominent epidemiologist in the field of autism, and he's proposed, based on a study that he's done some time ago, it's not current, it was in the late 90s, that perhaps although autism and Down syndrome co-occur at a higher prevalence than the general population, higher than expected in the general population, he threw out the proposal that, in fact, it was lower than expected compared to other children with cognitive problems. And for his to make this statement, he looked at a sample of children in receiving developmental services, and of the children with autism, the prevalence of Down syndrome was about 2%, and the kids without autism, the prevalence of Down syndrome was over 5%. So I would like to throw that out to you for your comments or some proposals for good comparisons to make to assess this difference in this apparent discrepancy in the prevalence of these co-occurring conditions in kids with or without the cognitive problems.
I think that DeBilt study, the DeBilt and Krager group that looked at 800 children in a health district in the Netherlands, came up with pretty much the 17% that Colorado found in their preliminary data when they looked at a total population of individuals with intellectual disability.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you
so the 17% was of children with intellectual disability and autism?
Who also were positive for clinical diagnoses of autism spectrum disorders. And it's pretty remarkable that that's the same number that came up on your preliminary data.
No, that was 1.7%.
No, I think when you look at autism spectrum and autism, you get to that, about 24%, I believe it is.
24%.
Yeah, but I think it's right in that range. And what I find very interesting about that is, to me, it depends on what you see as the core of autism. I've been trained in a model that really emphasizes social development. And as I've read through the literature, it seems as though sometimes, particularly in some of the studies in Europe, presentation in the third triad of repetitive behaviors coupled with a communication impairment is sometimes landing the children in a PDD-NOS diagnostic category. And while we look at DSM-4, and technically the DSM describes an OR statement, a problem in one or two of the following areas, social or communication or repetitive activities, I believe that autism is a core social impairment, and the idea that problems in social need to happen, and then PDD and OS would be implicated if it was a problem in either communication or repetitive activities. That distinction would really change how many children with an intellectual disability end up with an autism diagnosis. Because in my experience, if social is intact, we still get a lot of observations of significant repetitive behaviors and a communication impairment. So do we attribute that to the Down syndrome, or do we look at that as a form of PDD and OS? It's a good question.
Well, do you think the children with Down syndrome have, which is sort of leading into my next series of questions, do you think that association with autism is going to be different than from other children with cognitive disability? Do you think it's a different manifestation?
That's a great question. I feel like the phenotype looks different. This is Susan in Colorado, but I think it's something we have to continue to explore, and we've been having some good conversations with the clinicians at Rochester to try to talk about what we're observing that seems to kind of flavor the autism phenotype within a child with Down syndrome. It's tricky because when I think about autism symptoms in a child with another intellectual disability, that's a hard comparison for me to try to pull up and apply. I would need to look at that more systematically. Susan, what do you think?
We actually have had a fair number of discussions, Diana, about this very topic, and I would echo what Susan in Colorado was saying. We've discussed whether the pattern of stereotype behavior is what sets these children apart, whether their communication differences may engender different phenotypic classification over the lifespan, with younger children appearing different than older children. And that really is, I mean, that's the question. Does this represent a different phenotype, and what will that tell us about the neurobiology?
Well, now that you've sort of come to beginning to see this, I mean, I was interested to know what kinds of comparisons or how you might tease out, how would you manage to approach this, teasing out this very problem, whether it's comparisons with other children with different cognitive abilities or reasons for their cognitive disability, or what? What was your sort of thought on how to tease those, answer that question?
Diana, this is Sue Lynn. I'm just going to interject. So I want to give the audience the ask questions. I know we're starting this very very dynamic discussion at this point, but we're just to be conscious of time. We want to give the audience that's on the line with us right now an opportunity to ask questions. So if I could just hold off on your
oh, sure.
At
that's
this
fine.
Point. If the operator can come on and give instructions about how the audience members can ask questions, that would be greatly appreciated. Operator?
In order to ask a question, please press star and then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
So audience, please go ahead and follow those instructions. And if you would like to ask a question, please do so now.
Again, to ask a question, please press star and then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You do have a question from Mary Beth Paul.
Yes.
Mary Beth, your line is open.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio, and my son, who is 17 and was diagnosed with Down syndrome, he was diagnosed with autism at age 8. He is he just finished participating in a study with Bonnie Patterson. Actually, it was her. There's a dual diagnosis clinic at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and I know I'm thrilled that there are these big studies going on now around the country, and I just. This is not in the exact same thing because they're looking at blood markers. But are you all talking to one another?
This is Susan in New York. We haven't, at least I haven't discussed this study with them, but their study is extraordinarily interesting because they found a gene on chromosome 21 may be associated with regression in people with autism. So one of the things that we're very, very interested in looking at in our combined population of youngsters with Down syndrome is whether or not you get the same amount of reported regression that you do in children who have autism for other reasons, or whether you find regression in children with Down syndrome that has been unreported thus far.
Okay.
So that the Cincinnati group is doing incredibly interesting things.
Well, I'm just thrilled that this is even in existence today to be able to sit here and hear you all discuss this. So I thank you very much, and I'll pass on to the next question.
Thank you.
Next person.
Your next question comes from the line of Ann Haig.
Go ahead. Hello. I'm just curious. I'm hearing an awful lot about children with Down syndrome who are also presenting with Asperger syndrome. And you know, looking at DSM-4, the two just don't seem to marry at all. And I'm wondering if you've seen any of that or if you're supporting any kind of protocol that would show that kind of comorbidity.
This is Susan in Colorado. I believe that the criteria for Asperger require cognitive functioning within the average range and no history of a delay in communication. So
that's right.
I have not, in my clinical experience, met a child with Down syndrome who would have fit into those criteria. In fact, I find it interesting that we have so few children with Down syndrome in our sample who have relatively good cognitive skills who seem to come up on the autism measures with a high rate of symptoms. So I think to answer your question, we sort of have to address it in two ways. One would be the diagnostic criteria for Asperger's is incompatible, in my mind, with sort of a technical read, with a condition that involves mental retardation. And then secondly, to consider that within the children we have met with Down syndrome who seem to have some features of autism spectrum disorders, they tend to fall more in the category of full autism or PDD and OS.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
At this time, there are no further questions.
There was some questions that were submitted via text messaging, and I was wondering if, Ilya, you could read off some of those questions that have been submitted by the audience.
Sure, I'll go ahead and do that. The first question was, and I believe this is for the New York group, based on the current research and your findings, the current gold standard diagnosis, about only half of individuals with intellectual disability may have a diagnosis of autism. Is that your finding?
No, the screening data that we presented today was that half of the children that we screened to date came up positive on either the MCHAT or the SCQ. This doesn't mean that these screening tests really tap into the core deficits in individuals with intellectual disability. It's not clear whether they overread, which is more probable, or just miss entirely, which is why we're going on and doing ADIs on people who are screen positive and screen negative, as the Colorado group is as well. One of the goals of the combined projects is to determine whether these are the right instruments to use or whether a different interpretation or different scoring means of these current instruments would be more appropriate for people with intellectual disability, including Down syndrome.
Another question was, I think, for the Colorado group, are there any reimbursements or incentives for participants, and how many attempts or follow-ups are made to the no response?
Great question. Yes, we do use reimbursement for the assessment sessions. We ask that families are visiting with us three times for two-hour sessions. Two of those involve the child and one is parent only. And for each visit, the family is paid, receives $20 for their time. As far as trying to look at ways to increase our recruitment, we did find that we had some better responses, and I can look at the numbers. I need to look at the numbers to give you a more clear answer, but we had some improvement when we sent out the initial letters with a little bit of an incentive. So people responded more to that. Our follow-up call protocol has been we sent out the letters through the Department of Public Health. We also worked with Mile High Down Syndrome Society, and they sent out some letters. And then we did workshops and a lot of community events. And the Department of Public Health did not do a remailing, but Mile High Down Syndrome did send out a second time. When we've received calls from the project, we haven't lost too many people, but we do need to find some creative ways to try to reach folks. And we're looking at our numbers. The reason we needed to increase the size of the screen negative group is we wanted to make sure that we weren't differentially hearing from more parents who had social and communication concerns. So we've also talked about our project as looking at individual differences within Down syndrome in the hopes that we would pull in a representative sample and not just people who are already worried about the things that we're ready to study. I hope that addresses that question. Are there other?
We also have Down syndrome is a genetic disorder and autism a developmental disorder. However, some believe autism is genetic. Is there anything to support this belief, and what is your opinion, since there are some similarities and characteristics between the two?
This is Susan in New York. Actually, they're both genetic disorders. Down syndrome is a chromosomal disorder with, you see one of a couple of different obvious chromosomal differences. Autism is generally considered to be a multifactorial disorder with a strong genetic component with some environmental influences. It's not like Down syndrome where you can see one chromosome being abnormal, but it's multiple genes responsible for specific traits, and these genes may or may not be abnormal under all embryologic circumstances. There may be environmental factors that turn these genes on and off, both prenatally and postnatally. There's a tremendous amount of research that has told us a lot of what autism isn't, and a lot of what it isn't is a single gene disorder or a single chromosome disorder. But there's a very, very strong genetic influence. Family studies have demonstrated that although autism isn't inherited like eye color or hair color, that there is heritability in families, and it's related to this multifactorial influence plus these other factors that if we knew the answer, we'd tell. Diana would love it.
Well, folks, we are coming right on the 5 o'clock Eastern time time mark, and I know there are some other questions that we haven't addressed, and what I'll be able to do is to share those questions with the presenters afterwards, and then if once they've addressed those questions, I will provide either we'll post them on the AUCD website or through another medium and be able to answer those questions for you. The presentations will be archived. We're also going to record. We have recorded this webinar today, and it will be available for download from the AUCD website. So I will be sending out more information to the participants today on how to be able to access that information. The other point that I wanted to make is that both projects are still in the midst of, you know, data collection, data analysis, and we hope to come back, you know, sometime next year to give you the sort of the final analysis of these two projects. And so hopefully you will join us again next year when the two projects have wrapped up to hear about what their final findings are for both projects. So on behalf of AUCD, I would like to thank our presenters from New York, Dr. Salkos and Dr. Hyman, and from Colorado, Dr. Robinson and Dr. Hepburn, and a special thanks to Diana Shendell from the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities for providing us with such insightful comments. Thank you to the participants for joining us today. We had a very high attendance rate, and we know this is a topic that's dear to many of our hearts. So thank you for your attendance. And with that, I'm going to close off the webinar, and if anybody has any questions or would like to follow up, feel free to contact me at AUCD for any of those additional questions. So thank you all.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.